So let's get back to not my stub toe, but pain, which is an enormous issue. I'm sure in your daily practice, you see people who are just not getting better from their pain, and it's a problem. And in the United States, that's one of the causes of all these deaths from narcotics used in medicine.
Which is something that we cover in this interview. But chronic pain, I feel like we cover a lot on the show, Norman. We often talk about osteoarthritis pain. Recently, we talked about chronic pelvic pain. And psychological interventions are often mentioned. But we haven't quite explored what psychology for pain looks like. What does it involve? What's the evidence behind it? What's the role of the brain when it comes to pain?
And as soon as you say psychology, people say, oh, you're just saying it's in my head. I'm imagining my pain, which is in fact far from the truth.
It is far from the truth. And perhaps there is a problem with how health professionals communicate it to patients. But I spoke to an expert to find out all of these things. The person I spoke with is Professor Michael Nicholas, who's a clinical psychologist with over 40 years of experience in the field of pain. He's currently at the Pain Management Research Institute at the University of Sydney.
Naturally, people are sensitive to the idea that the brain might have something to do with pain, because in many parts of the world, that's a bit like saying it's all in your head. It's not real. But if you try to think about, well, what is pain? And it's not just what hurts, because what hurts is pain. So that sort of definition goes around in circles. So one way of thinking about pain that has been agreed to by pain scientists around the world is that it's better described as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with, or resembling that associated with, actual or potential tissue damage. Now, the key points in that definition of pain is that it's a sensory and emotional experience. So it's not a thing. You can't x-ray pain. You can x-ray bones and you can see fractures, but you can't find pain on a scan. But everybody knows what it is. And some describe it as a sensation, but it's more than a sensation because, you know, it can be quite distressing. And that's already areas where you can see how the brain is involved.
You just said before you can't x-ray pain. So people might have normal imaging, normal CT scans, x-rays, but still have really persistent low back pain, chronic pain. What's happening there with the brain when there's nothing seen potentially on the scan, but there's still a really significant impact on someone's quality of life and their sleep?
Well, chronic pain is defined as pain that persists for more than 3 months. And back pain is probably the most common example. Back pain can be quite intrusive and disabling, but lots of people also have back pain who are not disabled, but who continue to work and function and manage, and it's not a major problem. So just having pain itself is not all there is to it. The impact it has on you, it really depends on its significance for you. Is it interfering with your work? Is it stopping you earning a living? Is it interfering in your relationships? Equally, if you're worried that it's a sign of something terrible going on, like it's a sign of cancer or tumour, then you're likely to get anxious and want to seek reassurance that it's okay. A lot of back pain, for example, it doesn't have clear biological findings, but it's still real. It's just as real as pain where you can find biological, you know, physiological changes. The role of the brain here is not passive, just getting signals coming in from the pain site, but it plays an active role in interpreting what we're doing, what we're experiencing. There are associations between what we feel and previous events. There are memories that can be triggered by sensations. So the brain plays this active role.
So it's a lot about context of the person and maybe previous experiences that really can impact how much the pain kind of intrudes on someone's life or how much it actually impacts their quality of life.
Definitely, yes. Yeah. So the old days, but I think this still
you sound like
still
Norman.
Happens. Yeah, it still happens that when people have pain, they expect to find something physically wrong with them and it should show up on a scan. And when it doesn't, then people either themselves worry that they're just imagining it, or they feel that other people, like their doctor, might think that as well. In fact, we now know there's a very poor relationship between tissue damage and the amount of pain you feel. So someone can have a minor or no clear physical changes or damage and feel pain, or they can have a lot of damage and feel very little pain. So two people may have back pain, but it may have a completely different impact on one compared to the other. And this is often because of the context of their pain, as you mentioned, the significance it has for them, the way they're thinking about it, the way they're reacting to it, will influence what they feel. And so if you're trying to intervene in that, you must firstly assess what are those factors contributing to that person's pain, rather than just having an X-ray or a CT scan and saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, you're fine.
So then how does psychology interventions, Michael, how do they work in someone with chronic pain?
Firstly, we've got to, as I was just indicating, try to assess what are these contributors, what is going on here, what are the thought processes, what's the significance of this experience to the person, what do they think is going on, what are their concerns. In other words, we're not trying to make a sort of a psychiatric diagnosis out of this, like saying they're just depressed and this is just a symptom of depression, which pain can be, actually.
It can be, but not always, isn't it? Because I think
I
think sometimes people, if they're referred to a psychologist for chronic pain, either there's not enough communication from the health professional saying, you know, this psychology is really targeted to the brain for pain. And often people might feel dismissed or as if they're being labelled with a mood disorder when they may not feel they have one. So I think it's important to remind everyone that chronic pain can exist in the absence of other diagnoses in the mental health space.
Oh, yes. So that assessment process is the first step, and it's critical because each person is an individual and that we've got to understand their experience rather than just lump them all together and say, well, I've got back pain, so this is the treatment for back pain. I recommend people think about this as a person with back pain. We're not seeing back pain because we can't see it. It's an experience. What we're seeing is a person who's experiencing this, and it's causing them enough concern that they've sought help. So that's what we need to understand first. What are their concerns? And then we must address those when we intervene. There's no use giving them just analgesics by themselves. They can have a place, but it's a very small place. Most of them are quite ineffective. If they have any back, they don't last long. So people have to learn to manage it themselves once it becomes chronic. And to do that, it's got to make sense to them. So that's our first task. Whether you're a psychologist or a GP or a specialist, you need to help the person make sense of what they're experiencing and don't just label them.
Do you think we're good at that, Michael?
No.
Clinicians, yeah. So what needs to change then? Does there need to be more pain education in consulting rooms?
Yes. Not just in consulting rooms. It needs to be for all health professionals, because all health professionals, whether they're a doctor or a nurse, a physiotherapist, a psychologist, will see people in pain. It's one of the most common reasons people seek help. And yet we are all poorly trained in how to assess pain and how to help people with their pain. And this is why we actually developed these problems like with the opioids, because people were said, if a so-called weak drug like paracetamol wasn't working, they'd say take something stronger, which meant taking opioids. And that's what led to all the problems that we have had. And obviously, the United States is even worse. It comes from a failure of the health professionals to properly assess and understand a person's pain and help them understand what's going on and developing a plan with the person and not seeing them as just a pain complainer, but rather a person with pain that's causing them concern. If they become disillusioned with the health system or with the treatment they're getting, that's obviously when you can start feeling rather helpless or hopeless and get depressed. But it's a result of the way they've been managed. It's not the cause of the problem, but it will have a feedback loop and make the experience even worse.
Even worse, yeah. When it comes to the psychology interventions that have evidence for chronic pain, what does it look like?
Well, firstly, there's no magic bullet. You know, do this and it'll all go away. That's a total failure to understand the problem. The most studied broad treatment group comes under the heading of cognitive behavioural therapies. which means you look at the way people are thinking, the way they're reacting, the way they're behaving, the way they're interacting with their experience and also with people around them, and work out with the person. You can't do CBT to people, you do it with them, what might be appropriate for them. And that may include relaxation, it may include mindfulness, but often it'll include exercise, because often people stop doing things because of pain. And that leads to secondary deconditioning type effects. And then people can develop, some develop like a fear or belief that they can't do things in pain. When what we've found is that belief that you can't do things in pain is one of the most powerful predictors of disability.
So if you believe that pain is a bad thing, if you don't move, then it can actually negatively impact your outcomes.
Yes. And we've shown in numbers of studies in this country and internationally that it's that belief that you can't do things that is more powerful than fear. But you can change that belief by being guided by a physiotherapist or a psychologist or your doctor to gradually start doing the things you've been avoiding because you didn't believe you could do them. Not overdoing things, because that's one of the dangers, is people behave according to their pain. So when their pain is low, they do more. And then when that stirs the pain up, they stop doing things. That's sort of what's called a boom-bust style of behavior. What we try to do is get people to learn how to pace their activities without aggravating the pain all the time.
So it's about reframing, re-educating, and really taking the whole person into context, their experience of pain and any kind of previous history.
Yes, yes, yes. And discussing those with the patient, if we need to treat each person as an adult and have a discussion with them, because they are the ones who've actually got to manage it. I often say to medical students and specialists training in pain management that we don't manage pain at all. It's the patient who manages pain.
Yeah, you're giving them the tools.
And what we have to do is help them. Yes, we can teach them strategies, give them information, and be a sounding board. But it's very important that we avoid simple explanations, as if there's one simple solution. And you see, you just have to Google back pain and you'll see thousands of pages of absolute rubbish. People saying that, you know, they did this and it all went away, but it doesn't actually have to go away. And that's the whole beauty of the psychological aspect, is that if you realize that actually it doesn't have to stop you functioning, you can get back to work, you can live an active and full life despite pain, then pain will be much less of a problem for you. But chasing complete pain relief is a big mistake. Because that's what leads you into all these different drugs, which don't work in the end.
For people listening, Michael, who might be thinking, you know, I've been struggling with chronic pain, maybe it's chronic pelvic pain, neck pain, back pain. How do you find a psychologist or a clinician who is skilled in this space? What can we tell people to help guide them potentially?
It's a good question.
Can we all come and see you, Michael?
No, I wouldn't recommend that. Firstly, I would see my GP. That medical assessment is very important. A lot of people go to a physio, but really you need to see someone you feel confident in, you have some trust in, and start that process. Public hospitals all have a pain clinic these days. There is a waiting list for many, which is a problem. I mean, one of the things we have developed just recently is an online pain education network for health professionals. So I would ask any health professional who's offering to help with my pain what training they've actually had in pain management. And the reality is very few have had that.
I'm just curious, Michael, what's your approach if someone is referred to you with chronic pain who's slightly resistant? Maybe they feel as if they've been dismissed with the referral, or they're being told that the pain is in their head. What is your approach with that patient?
It's quite common, of course, because people say, look, my pain's in my back or my foot, it's not in my head. So as a psychologist myself, I get that sort of comment, and I quite understand that. That's the community norm, to see things are either physical or psychological. But we actually look at these things as being both physical and psychological. And we need, therefore, to understand what's going on in both domains. So what I start with is not trying to justify my existence to the person, but rather I'd start to say, well, why don't we actually try to clarify what the problems are? And when we do that, we identify that, you know, the pain's stopping them doing things. They're getting frustrated and angry about it. They're finding the treatments they're getting are not really working. Well, I show people how one thing's led to another as their pain has gone on. They can then quite quickly see that it's not all about what's going on in their back. In fact, once it becomes chronic, the origins of pain have probably got very little to do with what you're experiencing now, what the impact is. It's going to be much more to do with your behavior, the way you're thinking about it, the way you're feeling and interacting. Then people start to see, well, actually, there are a lot of psychological aspects that didn't cause the problem, but have become entangled with it.
Yes, entangled.
And the thing is, you can do something about these things. It's, you know, we can talk about what's going on in your nervous system, but most of us have no ability to directly change that. But what we can do is change our behaviour. We can change the way we think.
That was Professor Michael Nicholas, who is a very experienced clinical psychologist in the field of pain.
A really great interview, Priya, and really comprehensive. Michael knows as much, if not more, than a lot of people in Australia. But the sort of service he provides at North Shore Hospital in Sydney, which is multidisciplinary, a lot of people involved, a lot of training involved, is not available easily elsewhere in Australia. I mean, you have excellent pain centres, but they're overwhelmed.
And I think that's important to acknowledge, that if you really get that gold standard of care in chronic pain, which Michael mentions, with physiotherapist, psychology, a health professional like a GP, it can be quite costly if you're not in one of those public pain management units, because the wait list is so long, or you might need services more acutely. It can be quite expensive, even with a GP management plan or subsidies from the government.
And we'll have links to some key resources that might help you on our show notes.